Welcome to Worlds Apart. They hate us, our way of life, our freedom, our democracy. For decades, that has been the catch-all justification for the United States to go to war or to impose sanctions with little consideration for the costs or the consequences. Or at least that was the case until Washington moved to sanction the entire world in its effort to penalize Russia. Have the Americans finally bitten off more than they can chew? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Sarah Flanders, an American political writer and an anti-war activist. Sarah, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
It's good to be here talking.
Now, you've been part of an anti-war and anti-sanction group since the 1960s. And if we look at the American war expenses or spending over that period of time, what's really interesting that is that it significantly increased after the end of the Cold War, which the United States presumably won, and when the history presumably ended. How do you explain such a paradox that the Americans chose to spend all that money on war at the time of their highest historical glory and arguably at the most peaceful time that humanity has ever been to?
Well, the expectation at the end of the Cold War is that there would be a peace dividend, that the billions and billions spent on war would now finally be used for social programs, desperately needed social programs in the U.S., and that the U.S. around the world would use that money in the reconstruction in help for so many countries. But I want to say that there were a small group of people in the U.S. that really felt that the end of the Cold War meant a new period of reconquest, of recolonization, that the U.S. was driven in the corporate power in the U.S. I don't mean the population that had such a hope for peace. I mean the corporations that really are the decision makers with their vast think tanks and political apparatus use this as a time to absolutely consolidate their power in the most brutal way. They began aggressively the expansion of NATO at the very moment that they had promised that NATO would not expand an inch to the east. And it was because they needed a police power in the countries of Eastern Europe to impose the new, extremely unequal, destructive capitalist relations throughout Eastern Europe.
Now, Sarah, you mentioned this unequal and exploitative relationship, and I think it applies not only to Eastern Europe, it actually applies all over the world, and even more so in the United States, because I myself studied there. I know that most Americans are very conscientious, hardworking, good-hearted people who, you know, want to do good both to their communities and to the world, who work hard, sometimes struggle to make ends meet. And yet, you know, this message that you have been championing for many decades either doesn't reach them or they don't seem to care. What is that? Why do you think the majority of Americans don't seem to be, you know, responding to the activism of people like yourself?
Well, one thing right here in the very center of this imperialist system. I mean, that is what this is. Corporate power has absolute control of the media, of the message, whether it is through the schools and the churches, but it is through every form of media from sports to entertainment. And it is a very controlled, contrived message. And it intentionally excludes any real criticism of the system and the way that it functions. So we're up against a propaganda machine. When they go to war, they're able to demonize overnight, have people who knew nothing about a country suddenly expert that there is a monster that must be dealt with immediately. And in the same way, I mean, there are breakthroughs that really happen. The Occupy Wall Street, the Black Lives Matter movement, there are moments where there is a real breakthrough by millions of people. But for the most part, they are able to keep a really tight clamp. There were moments against the Iraq war where there was millions in the street opposing that war. Of course, corporate power, the big corporations, the think tanks, the political establishment refused to listen. They shut it down. They're able to turn it off.
The Iraq case is probably the most publicized, but there were many, many cases like this. And in fact, you recently published an anthology that focuses on the impact of the U.S. sanctions on 40 countries. That's almost one third of the global population. And when you see it all combined, I think the most striking thing is not even the sort of the extent of harm and suffering that it has produced, but the absolute futility of that effort, because it does not bring those powers the desired political outcome. Why do you think they keep pressing that lever, over and over again? Is it still a political tool, a geopolitical tool, or simply, a means to sadism? Because, it seems to breed nothing but suffering.
It's intended to breed suffering. And it is intended to challenge any country that tries to exist outside of U.S. corporate control by cutting them off from every access to development and every ability to feed, provide medical care, education for their own population. Even countries that in no way could be a threat to the U.S., take small Cuba. So decades under sanctions and blockade. Why? Because Cuba was an example of what revolutionary change could do and throughout Latin America was looked to. So it was important for them to starve down Cuba in every way, to make and even travel to Cuba, let alone any sort of exchange with Cuba, all but impossible from the U.S., because for them, Cuba was a bad example. The same thing, tiny Nicaragua is considered a national security threat. Can you imagine? It defies reality. Yet it was a threat because they were attempting to make real change for the population. They declared free education and healthcare.
And there are many other examples which are listed in your anthology, but it's one thing to attempt to do that when you know that, the entire world will keep financing your debt. But it's no longer the case. And as we know from the recent collapses of some American banks, the American financial system is really tearing at the seams. And there are many countries that are divesting quietly from the American trade and financial system. And yet, the Biden administration just recently submitted to Congress a record-breaking budget. Record-breaking for military expenditures. How do you understand that logic? Because I think it defies common sense. Because the government still needs to finance the very modest social programs that exist in the United States. They still need to do that. Why are they spending like crazy?
This is an empire in decline and decay that is totally bound to one policy. They have the intellectual and political leadership shaped to only push for U.S. dominance, not any sort of collaboration with any country in the world. They have a huge military machine that has to justify its existence every moment. And it is a policy and a system that is in real decay. It no longer works. And we can see this in the failure of banks, that what is being pulled down is no longer other countries, but the U.S. system itself. And we are paying a terrible price right here in the United States today with one of the lowest levels of health care, infant mortality, women's maternity. You look at any of the figures, the U.S. is behind every other industrial country in the world.
Can I actually ask you about that? Because this is something that I could never really understand. I mean, if we look at structurally at the American budget, military spending and debt servicing are the two biggest articles that the government is spending upon. And as you mentioned, many of the social services, maternity leave, you know, public health care, free education, employment protections, you know, those things that are considered basic in many other countries, you know, the American package compared to that is very, very modest. And yet many Americans are still absolutely convinced of the superiority of that system. What is that belief based on? Why are the Americans so convinced that, you know, that system is the best and that it needs to be imposed onto others?
I don't know that they're so convinced. I know that the media has only one line, that this is the best possible world and the richest possible world and the best standard of living. And it's repeated relentlessly at the same time that poverty is growing. Opposition is not, there's every effort to contain it, to keep it from breaking through. It is breaking through, and it will, in big explosive changes, but not in a way that is reasonable or rational, because the system itself is becoming completely ossified. It is committed to military spending. The entire profitability of the system is based on supporting the largest corporations, which are military corporations. And the constant debt service is for past wars and military budgets. So the two biggest expenditures are this gargantuan military apparatus. It in every way, it also is like a drug. It can feel real good in the beginning. It pumped up the U.S. economy for decades. It enabled them to get out of recessions, a big infusion of money. It no longer works that way. There's no profit to be made in social programs, not the same rate of profit that there is in militarism. So the money goes to the military because it's profitable for those who are really powerful, control the levers of power, and the huge lobbying, control the donations to the politicians. It's the military corporations. And so no matter how progressive a politician may seem, they will vote time after time, raise their hand for the military budget. And every year, the military budget expands at a rate of about 10%. Regardless of what war, what the needs are. And at the same time, they will cut social programs because they say they have to balance the budget. So this continues every year, whether Democrat or Republican. They each make promises. They each, and every time they're in office, it's the lobbyists that just do the deciding.
Okay. Well, Sarah, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Operation Aerodynamic began shortly after World War II and lasted almost three decades.
It was a major effort to try and split the Ukraine off from the Soviet Union.
U.S. intelligence, together with Hitler's executioners, trained hundreds of saboteurs to be deployed in the Soviet Union.
Жестокость националистов, бандеровцев была абсолютно беспредельная. Ничего не стоило убить младенца, расчленить младенца.
Today's security service of Ukraine uses not only the sadistic methods, but also the ideology of the nationalists.
Это две женщины, с завязанными сзади руками, с контрольным гусем в голову.
Милости просим в Украине!
Добро пожаловать в Украину!
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Sarah Flanders, an American political writer and anti-war, anti-sanction activist. Sarah, it's not up to a Russian to tell the Americans how to live their lives, but I think it's important to mention that your country and the Americans, I mean, the ordinary Americans, are financing a war that is happening very close to my home. In fact, you know, some of my relatives live in Ukraine, and I know that you have your own view on that conflict. How do you see it in the larger frame of things?
Well, the war in Ukraine is a proxy war. It's a war against Russia. It's a war where the expectation was that Russia would collapse under the sheer weight of thousands of sanctions, not only from the US, but from the EU. And there was the expectation that the whole world would join in. In that, the US lost sight of their slipping power, and really the great majority of the population of the world did not go along. And most important, China did not go along, but
well,
also
they didn't just go along. I interview many experts from around the world through my line of work, and I think nobody, well, very few people support Russia's actions because people don't like an open conflict, that's for sure. But they're very critical, if not fully disdainful, of the American foreign policy because they see it as not just futile, they see it as extremely dangerous. They think that, you know, Uncle Sam is not just being stubborn or arrogant, it's being mentally unstable, it's being dangerous, it's wrecking not only, you know, its own future, but everybody else's future. Do you think that's an exaggeration? And do you think people in America understand that?
I don't think it's understood in the United States at all. No, I don't think so. But it's extremely dangerous. This is a war. Both countries have nuclear weapons. Wars can escalate in the snap of a finger. This is an extremely dangerous time because increasingly the United States can't back up. They can't withdraw. They're committed to a failed policy. That is dangerous. And the only way they see of getting out of it is to expand the problem. And that is why the focus on Russia and on China, it seems to lack any sane explanation. And yet that is the direction that they're going. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you about this tactic of increasing the pressure? Because you have this saying in the American English, doubling down. We don't have, by the way, a direct translation in either Russian or Chinese, but essentially it means pursuing the same type of policy, even though it does not produce the desired outcome. And I think anyone who knows anything about either Russia or China, how they you know, go around their defenses, around their spending, it's pretty clear that the task of fighting against both of these great powers is futile. I mean, like it's impossible under any scenario. The Americans will not get what they want. How long do you think they will pursue it? Will they triple down? Will they quadruple down? And do they have the resources to carry out this kind of an offensive against the other two great powers, which seem to be far more calculative about their spending than the United States?
It is an irrational policy. The U.S. could not prevail against Afghanistan, about the poorest country in the world, the most divided, lacking any real military force. If they couldn't prevail against Afghanistan, how on earth do they think they can take on Russia and China? It defies logic, but it is the way of using threats in an attempt to maintain their dominance, and their dominance is past in terms of industrial and GDP, banking, finance, in every area, de-dollarization. The dollar no longer exists as supreme. They have not reevaluated this. So it's a very dangerous moment because you have a very powerful country that is refusing to accept reality. That's dangerous. Truly
that's
dangerous.
Absolutely dangerous. And I want to remind our viewers that the United States is the only country on record to use nuclear weapons without no tactical or strategic aim, just for the sheer purpose of destroying or humiliating. Do you think there is a viable risk of that happening again?
You have people in very powerful positions who could more easily imagine the end of the world than the end of their system. That's dangerous. And it really will take an explosion from below, including in the United States. What's happening in France today is very important because it's a refusal to accept the cutbacks and war that are a direct result of NATO's war in Ukraine. You see it being played out in a different way, refusing to accept a pension decrease, but it's really a struggle against what the war has imposed and the economic decline of Europe. Europe had more powerful, much larger volume of trade with Russia than with the U.S. How is the U.S. going to reverse that? By this war and the sanctions, they have broken that very profitable exchange between the EU, especially Germany, but also France, and Russia. They want to break it with China. It is a policy that is completely destructive, not only to the United States, also to the European Union, and disastrous for the countries, for example, throughout Africa, who rely on the grain and the industry and the oil and all of that that come from Russia. So that's why there is a real search, very consciously, for new ways of trade and exchange, and as I say, de-dollarization. This is now upon us.
Given what you said about the American elites being so bent on preserving their dominance, do you think they will allow the world to go that way? Because, I mean, everybody understands that it is dangerous to rely on the American financial system. It's not secure anymore. And yet, whenever other countries make an effort to, you know, facilitate conflict resolution, the United States is up against it. Do you think they will allow the world to leave as it wants to leave?
They will not accept this willingly at all. But I think we really are on the precipice of a complete economic collapse right here in the U.S. The banking system is so fragile. Which bank will fail next? And we certainly, with Credit Suisse, for a Swiss bank to fail, we can see that the whole economic system is bordering on collapse because these policies are so disastrous and they're not succeeding. Had the war in Ukraine succeeded in its aims, had they been able to destabilize Russia, impose regime change, break Russia up into pieces, which was their plan, then they might be on a new roll, a big boom. But that's not what happened. So there is a real economic disaster that is facing us now. Now, the countries that are pulling away from the U.S. have a better chance of surviving this collapse. And the new economic relations between Russia and China, also with India, with Iran, with countries throughout Africa, new trade deals in Latin America, with Brazil, with other countries. You see this happening everywhere. Countries anxious to trade with each other, and even historic enemies.
Now, many of my questions and comments may seem anti-American or tendentious, and I don't want them to sound this way because I admire many things about the United States, the people, you know, culture, many things about the society, how people can come together and organize the grassroots effort. And I think the Americans were extremely fortunate. I mean, historically, economically, socially, they were given an amazing civilizational chance to both excel themselves and to hopefully help others do that in a fair way. Do you think that chance is fully wasted, or do you think it still can be salvaged? What is the kind of America that can exist once this yoke of corporations and imperialism is removed?
Well, once it's removed, both the technology, the industrial base that's here, could liberate the world. U.S. agriculture could feed the world, as can Russia's, as can even Sudan.
Well, I think the world can can feed itself. It's a rather dangerous track, I mean, for the Americans to always think about that grandiosity. I speak to many Africans, and they don't want to be fat. They want to grow their own crops. And it's not Monsanto crops that they want to grow. They want to grow something that's natural and sustainable.
That's absolutely true. That's such a good point. I think there's a capacity to solve all the problems that humanity is facing today, especially the environmental, the climate. This is bearing down upon us. To solve these problems, if we could get this monster off our back of the military-industrial complex, as it's called, it actually acts in conjunction with the media, with the banks. It's a whole nugget, and it's very, very powerful. But it will take really a huge and enormous change coming from below to break this, to break through with it. There are many people in the U.S. involved in it. They're made to look small and marginalized. They're always underestimated. As the U.S. underestimates its opponents around the world, they underestimate movements within the U.S. And we should just be aware of that. Their role is to appear all powerful to the world, to never allow voices of dissent to really come through. And yet that opposition is there and is growing, particularly among the youth, who don't buy the so-called American dream, and also who understand that this country, yes, great potential, great population, but it was also built on the trade of African people, the enslavement, the genocide of the indigenous population. It has a very brutal history from its founding days. And we shouldn't forget that, because if we're going to build a new world, we have to really have reparations for the crimes of the past. We have to identify the enormous inequality and injustice and crimes of the past. That's important. And the crimes against the world, the crimes against the population right here.
Well, Sarah, that's up to you Americans to do. I think the only thing I'm concerned about is that the Americans finally learn how to leave and let leave, and the world immediately will be a better and safer place after that. We have to leave it there, but I greatly appreciate your conversation today. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Very thoughtful.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.